The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always. The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. Last week, had a very interesting conversation with Dr. Justin Wheeler from Primary Children's about workup of abdominal pain in the office. This week, we want to talk about treating functional abdominal pain. Welcome back, Justin.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Are there any conflicts that you need to report on?
No conflicts of interest.
My suspicion is that over the course of this podcast, we'll talk about some off-label medication uses, and you'll point those out as we get to them.
Correct. Yeah, many of the interventions used for functional abdominal pain are off-label.
So let's clarify just a little bit, because you know we use the term functional all the time. What does functional abdominal pain mean?
Good question. And I think that's a question that many, many people have. It used to be called recurrent abdominal pain. So there is a physician named John Apley who did a study back in 1958, and we all kind of rue the day that he invented abdominal pain, but I'm sure it existed before. but yeah, he came up with this term, and it didn't quite fit with everything that people would see. And so this terminology, functional abdominal pain, came about. Functional just refers to the fact that there's no evidence of organic disease. It's nothing that's causing injury. It's related to the function of the GI tract, but not necessarily dysfunction. So functional abdominal pain is, we've been trying to come up with a better term. They've had chronic recurrent abdominal pain.
Terrible acronym.
Bad acronym. So right now we're kind of stuck with functional abdominal pain disorders. That's what it is.
So as you describe it, just the cost of doing business, right?
Cost of doing business.
you've got this, I'm still intrigued by this double cat brain of neurons populating a gut. And the other thing is, we didn't mention this last time, and I don't want to expand on it forever, but I do think that that there's increasing interest, at least, and probably clarity about the role of the microbiome in the, you know, this zoo that lives in our cat's brain of gut that complicates the whole thing a little bit. Is that true?
It is true. You know, the interaction between the microbiome in our body is this very complicated process that we really don't understand 100%, but there have been really fascinating studies coming out examining this. So they found that, well, I guess first of all, if you were to count all the bacterial cells in your gut, there's more of them than there are of us. So there's more bacterial cells in your intestines than there are cells of yourself. There's just a massive, massive amount of bacteria in us. They're just much smaller cells. And understanding how they work and what effects they have on our body is just a fascinating area of study. They've shown that the microbiome can have effects on obesity, for example, on weight gain. They've taken mice and who were previously not obese. They transplanted a microbiome into a mouse without a microbiome, and then subsequently that mouse became obese. So it clearly affects the way we absorb nutrition, clearly affects the way that our body interacts with what we expose it to. The bacteria in the gut, they've shown that there's some bacteria that make byproducts, things like butyrate and things like that, that could be related to sensitization or decreased sensitization of the nerves in the gut. And so irritable bowel syndrome, for example, in some studies, they've shown that changing the microbiome can significantly decrease irritable bowel syndrome symptoms. So yes, it's a fascinating area of study. One that I think is still in its infancy. Most parents ask me about this. They say, will a probiotic be helpful? And I don't know, what do you usually say to your patients?
Maybe.
Maybe, yeah. It's a good response. I often tell them that it's probably just making your poop expensive. Because there just isn't enough evidence out there to tell us what types of bacteria we're supposed to give to our patients and when's the right time. You know, there have been some really good studies looking at large populations after diarrheal illnesses or use of antibiotics and things like that. And so there is some data out there, but for patients who have chronic abdominal pain, irritable bowel syndrome, at least in pediatrics, there's the jury's still out a little bit. There has been some evidence that a multi-strain probiotic that have many different strains and have high bacteria counts might be one that you could consider to help IBS, but you know, there's not concrete evidence that it's universally helpful.
It does seem that in a population that tends to reflect what you acquire soon after you're born, that a cup of yogurt isn't going to throw that very far off where it's always been.
Correct. And another interesting study that they've talked about is that your microbiome shifts substantially fairly regularly. They've done some studies and shown that within 3 days of moving in with somebody or sharing a habitat, your microbiomes will actually shift. So I don't know if that sends chills down your spine or not, or makes you really want to wash your hands more, but it is a highly influenceable and fluid population that lives in your gut.
Yeah, you know, deadly viruses notwithstanding, I'm a fairly pragmatic guy, and we live in a germy world, and that's just the world where we live. So I think you just come to grips with it. This has kind of been a little bit of a digression. Is there a practical difference between functional abdominal pain, irritable bowel syndrome, and dyspepsia syndrome? Is it important for us to keep those straight?
I think it is, because it can help you decide how you're going to treat patients, and it also allows you to give a diagnosis. I think oftentimes with functional abdominal pain, families really need a diagnosis. They don't need to hear, I don't know what's going on, but it doesn't look like it's anything dangerous. Instead, I think it's more beneficial for them to hear, great news, I know what you have, this is what you have, and this is why. And so using the definitions we have from, for example, the Rome 4 criteria that's published, to, you know, definitions of clinical diagnoses, of GI diagnoses that are functional in nature, one of the differentiating those diagnoses is important. So functional dyspepsia, that is defined as postprandial fullness. So you feel full after you eat. You might get early satiation, so you're not hungry after you eat. You have epigastric pain or burning that's not associated with defecation. So that is functional dyspepsia. So that is a diagnosis. And you might focus your treatment accordingly, and you give the family that diagnosis. While IBS, like we've talked about on the last show, we talked about how it's related to changes in frequency or form in your stool, and the pain doesn't go away if you just treat the constipation, for example, that the pain is persistent, but you do have changes. So those will have a completely different set of management strategies. Well, functional abdominal pain syndrome is when you don't have IBS, you don't have functional dyspepsia, you don't have something like abdominal migraine, for example. It's a catch-all if you just have abdominal pain, episodic or continuous, that does not occur solely during a physiologic event like eating or menses or something like that. That is functional abdominal pain.
You mentioned the word management. That's probably an important part of education about this, isn't it? That we hope to aim as much as anything is management as opposed to a cure, that we're going to fix this and it'll never be an issue again.
That's a really great point. So, you know, education upfront and expectation is the foundation of treating GI disease. You know, in medicine, they often talk about, historically, you make a diagnosis so you can provide a prognosis. So you make the diagnosis of abdominal pain, functional abdominal pain, and then that leads you to the prognosis. And the prognosis is that this isn't going to cause injury to your child. This isn't going to affect the way that they necessarily grow and develop. But it is probably going to stick around for a while, and we're not going to be able to make it go away 100%. And so you're right, identifying and letting families know up front what to expect, that you're probably not going to make it go away, but our goal is to get you back into participating in daily life activities, doing the things that they like to do and enjoy, and get them back to feeling better by identifying and avoiding triggers is really, really important.
So what are the overall broad expectations? What are some of the things that we know are going to help with this? For instance, in the realm of behavior modification.
Right. Excellent question. So behavioral medicine is an integral part. We found more and more as we've learned about functional abdominal pain and making kids feel better. So some of the best outcomes we've had of randomized control studies of kids with functional abdominal pain, what interventions work? Cognitive behavioral therapy is one of the best interventions that you can come up with. Now, cognitive behavioral therapy is basically retraining the brain how to interpret these signals when they're coming up from your body, how to redirect. And some of the theory behind it is that when you redirect the way that you think and react to pain, then your brain is actually going to remodel with time, that it no longer, you know, gets those amplified signals up from your gut. Sometimes I talk about how, you know, your brain and your belly are frenemies, is what I tell my patients sometimes. They sometimes get along and sometimes they don't. Typically, the communication between the belly and the brain should be a VIP only line, should be a small path that only the really important signals go through. And I think in kids who have functional abdominal pain or have amplification of normal digestive processes that are going on, that one lane back road private path turns into a six lane on, you know, freeway. It's I-15 at rush hour. So everything that's going on in the brain, stress, anxiety, gets magnified in the belly, and then vice versa, where, you know, you get a little backed up, get some gas, it just amplifies.
Are there general principles of cognitive behavioral therapy that people can improvise or that we can teach, or do more people need to have expert training? I'm referring to families here.
Right, for families. So it's a skill that families can learn. And there's, with, you know, with the internet, there's fantastic resources available. Primary Children's actually has rolled out and is piloting doing cognitive behavioral therapy through Zoom meetings. So being able to learn some of these skills in a group setting from a provider and being able to learn those skills. There's other online resources as well. I think that it, you know, unless you've had experience yourself as a provider, it might be a little time consuming to teach families how to do it. So I think use those, use behavioral medicine experts that are in the community and or in your office, use them to their full extent, licensed clinical social workers and such to help your families out.
Great advice. And also, as you alluded to last week, there's often a whole principle of getting a whole family on board with this. It's not just the patient that we're treating sometimes, but it's treating a whole family's pattern of approach to things and anxieties.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think being cognizant of that up front is important. So if mom is having stress, we might discount how much a child appreciates that and tunes into stressors outside of themselves. And there have been families that we've actually referred for family therapy where parents learn to cope with stress and it actually helps the child. But having a pain talk with families is important, like making sure that they understand that you understand their child is uncomfortable and let them know that the pain is real, but maybe giving it a good comparison to something like headaches or growing pains, something that they can put in that they're familiar with and they know doesn't necessarily cause damage, but the pain is real. And sometimes when parents hear that and they recognize that you recognize the pain is real, it might help them buy into your subsequent recommendations.
Are there pain interventions that are helpful? I mean, patients who will come in having tried, you know, acetaminophen or ibuprofen?
Oftentimes, I very, very rarely see a patient in my office who says, yeah, every time I take Tylenol, my pain goes away. That, right. Unfortunately, the pain in the GI tract doesn't respond very well to that. Similarly, opioids are typically not helpful for visceral pain that comes with the GI tract. So
definitely maybe counterproductive.
Right. Counterproductive. Exactly. So yeah, very, very rarely do those kinds of medicines really, you know, solve the problem.
So what are some of the other management things that we can do besides helping them with cognitive behavioral therapy? Are there triggers that people can avoid?
Excellent question. So the first thing I focus on is lifestyle change. So oftentimes the trigger for a patient might be related to something that's going on in their life. First of all, sleep. Many, many of our children who have functional abdominal pain kind of get out of the normal circadian rhythms. They have belly pain, so they don't go to sleep at night. So they stay up late watching movies and then they sleep in, or they have a hard time getting up to go to school. So then they get behind in school and then they get stressed, so their belly hurts more. It's just a vicious cycle. So addressing sleep up front is a very easy thing to do. Talk about sleep hygiene, getting kids to go to bed at an appropriate time, making sure there's not screens on in the room or distractions, screens, you know, texting and things that might be waking them up at night. Getting good sleep, for some kids, they find that's their trigger. When they're not sleeping well and rested, their belly hurts more, they might have nausea or other symptoms. So adequate sleep is one thing they can do. Exercise and hydration is another one that's important. They've done studies looking at the value of exercise for things like depression and anxiety, and it's definitely shown to be extremely helpful. And similarly with functional abdominal pain, getting out and being active, doing it in a stepwise manner. You know, don't overdo it on day one. But those things can really make good progress. They've done studies looking at yoga in functional abdominal pain. They actually show that it can be helpful. So getting kids to be active. Hydrating is another one. Kids don't drink enough. You know, we live at high altitude here in Utah, and in the summers it's hot and dry, and sometimes just not getting enough water can contribute to things like constipation or dizziness and nausea and other functional symptoms that could improve with just better hydration. So yeah, lifestyle is a big deal. And then tracking their diet. So unfortunately, or as we all know, teenagers and kids are drawn to sugars and unhealthy foods. I can't count the number of times I've heard patients, you know, say that they just can't eat anything because their belly hurts, and the mom chimes in and says, but what about the Takis and the spicy hot Cheetos? For some reason, those are the go-tos. So they recognize it might make their symptoms worse. So verbalizing that can be really important, maybe avoiding.
And that may be off-label use of Cheetos, right?
You know, Cheetos probably argue it's on-label, but I don't know.
This is a very thorny issue. What about school attendance? What do you tell people?
Right. This is a little bit of a controversial topic. There are patients who have things like IBS or bad nausea or dyspepsia or pain, and they notice that first thing in the morning is just really rough. And by the time 9 or 10 o'clock hits, they're doing much, much better. Most of the time, you want kids back participating in regular life activities as expected. That means a regular school schedule and participating in those things the way they're supposed to. There are a subset of patients where we find that working with the school and with the patient and with the family, where they might have a bit of a delayed start, actually gets them way more mileage than any other medicine you can throw at them. So, you know, be flexible with your families. Keep things like that in mind. You know, it might not be the ideal, but an hour later start time, if it really is going to get that child to school and participating and take care of their pain, is not a bad way to go.
And clearly, you know, when you get in a cycle of, you know, so you've missed 2 weeks of school, and if stress is one of your triggers, it's a self-perpetuating problem after a while.
It really is. And I think kids get afraid to go back. And so, you know, it exacerbates the problem. And so verbalizing that, first of all, is important. So make sure that you recognize it and see if they can recognize it. And then working with the school to figure out a plan to get them back, even if it means a slow stepwise reintroduction, instead of just ripping the band-aid off, jumping into the cold pool. They might be more of a ease yourself in kind of individual. So coming up with a plan or helping the family talk through what that might look like could be helpful.
And if there's bowel irritability, it may not be a bad thing to somehow privately work out some way that kids have access to a restroom at school, because it's not always an easy thing.
Yeah, no kid wants to raise their hand and announce they need to go to the restroom. And so we've come up with signals for families or kids that they come up with their parents. You know, they take a 10-second or 20-second timeout, they do a little signal for their teacher, and then the teacher gives them a little nod and they're out the door. Most teachers are willing to work with kids. You know, they want them to be fine too. So yeah, great idea.
Last week we talked a little bit about diet changes, whether lactose or gluten or FODMAPs. To reiterate, what do you usually recommend under the circumstances?
Yeah, if families can identify and they feel that those foods are triggers, like they've noticed a correlation with eating dairy, then absolutely doing an empiric trial of removing the dairy from the diet for a period of time, and then adding that back in a systematic manner. So, you know, historically they say a FODMAP diet should be from anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks. More recent literature showed that you might be able to tell within 7 days if it's helpful. And so that might shorten the pain of following a diet like that where you're removing foods. But absolutely, if families feel like there's a correlation, try it. Take out the food, be diligent about it, add it back in, and look and see if symptoms are worse. You know, lactose intolerance is extremely common.
Sure.
Can absolutely contribute to symptoms. So, you know, sometimes families ask, if I take dairy out, will it make her constipation go away? There's no data to suggest that. But there is data to suggest if you have lactose intolerance and there seems to be improvement when you take it off, for sure. And oftentimes there's anecdotal evidence, might not bear out in populations, but in individuals, they for sure feel better if you take milk out because of the lactose, you take wheat out, maybe because of the fructans or fermentable sugars that are in wheat. Might not be the gluten, but it might just be those fructans, and they feel better.
People often talk about food intolerances synonymously with food allergies. Are allergies a major problem, do you think, in chronic abdominal pain?
I don't think so. You know, allergy typically presents as a very stereotypical response. Every time you eat the food, you have the same reaction or similar reaction of some sort. And I really don't see food allergy very often as being a driver. Food intolerance is much more common. They don't come to us usually if it's a food allergy. They find their way to the allergists because they have kind of a stereotypical finding of vomiting or hives or things like that.
Let's talk then about a few things that often get recommended to help with abdominal pain. You touched on probiotics. So you want to reiterate, do you recommend them very often?
In some patients we do. There have been some data to show that, like we said, a multi-strain probiotic could be helpful for someone who has IBS, diarrhea predominant specifically. In adults, there have been recommendations of that. The type of probiotic they studied was something called VSL3. It's now called Visbiome. Those are the brand names. I don't know if I'm supposed to say that, but those are the brand names they've done a lot of studies on. They've looked at 700 and some odd children where they looked at things like Lactobacillus reuteri or kind of Lactobacillus family, and they showed that there is moderate evidence that it might help, while other studies don't show any improvement. So it's a mixed bag on whether these things help or not. As long as it's not breaking the bank and the families are willing to do a limited trial, it's something you can absolutely do. But again, I think more often than not, it's probably just making our poop expensive.
What about just moving in with somebody with a better microbiome?
No, they haven't done the randomized study yet. They do know that there are individuals who have great microbiomes out there, though. So if you can find those people.
Designer microbiomes. What about fiber?
Good question. Yeah, fiber has actually been shown to be helpful for IBS. Things like Metamucil, which is a psyllium husk fiber, has been shown to be helpful for that. And it seems to decrease pain as well as bulk stool up in individuals who have IBS. So the number needed to treat that they quoted was about 6 individuals to have improvement in your IBS symptoms and in pain. In pediatric studies, they showed that there was a mean reduction in pain scores compared to placebo, but it didn't really affect stool pattern, but it does seem to be helpful. So things like acacia fiber or wheat dextrin fiber, that's brand name Benefiber, those are all things that you could try. They could be helpful.
Any speculation for why that makes a difference?
It's probably related to the microbiome, they think, in part. And another part is it might bulk the stool, make it a little softer, and ease transit through the GI tract.
And I should point out, in parenthetically, you are Mr. Transit, right? You're the motility guy.
Yeah, good. Yes, I am. I'm the neurogastroenterologist. My parents, you know, when I tell them that this is what I am, I think they kind of shake their head and say, "How did you get to this point?" And as a career end point for your career. But yeah, I'm a motility doctor. So I'm the only provider kind of in the Intermountain West that does motility testing. So it just evaluates the way that food moves through the GI tract kind of from mouth to bottom. But yeah, that's kind of my...
Which is kind of a big deal, right? Given that that's one of the major functions of GI tract. What about antispasmodics? So they're both pharmacologic antispasmodics, and some people recommend peppermint oil. Is there any utility?
Absolutely. Actually, those are things that we use a lot. So enteric-coated peppermint oil, they've actually done studies and they think that it acts by the menthol and peppermint blocking calcium channels, which can decrease spasm of smooth muscle in the gut. And so there is a proposed kind of theory of how it could work. And they've done double-blinded randomized control trials of these children, and they showed that it had, one study showed a 76% improvement compared to 19% improvement with placebo. So it was a study of 50 kids, but they did see pain improvement. So you know what? There's some evidence out there to show that it works. We usually make sure that families aren't using peppermint oil drops, so liquid peppermint oil. That might just give you peppermint burps. But you want enteric-coated peppermint capsules. There's a few different ones that are on the market. There's some that are marketed to have other things in them, like ginger or fennel, that you know might help with things like nausea. There's other ones that are marketed as having kind of little microspherules that might decrease reflux symptoms. Some patients have reported that when they use this, it helps the pain. They really like it. It's a nice natural intervention, but it can make your poops a little minty on the way out. So
where's the harm in that?
Right. So I just give families a heads up about that.
And besides, it's interesting because there are some people who really seem to warm to the idea of something as natural, something that's that hasn't been cooked up in a lab somewhere. What about antidiarrheals? Is there a role for that?
I'm going to speak to the antispasmodics, the medicines.
Okay, yes, please. Thank you.
So antispasmodics, things like hyoscyamine or dicyclamine, those medicines that I think in the GI world are probably the most refilled prescriptions in patients who have irritable bowel syndrome, meaning that it is helpful for many patients. Not across the board, but there's certainly a subset of patients who respond well to these medicines. They generally have a pretty safe side effect profile in that they're not addictive, and they can have anticholinergic effects of drying out the mouth or the eyes, maybe causing a little constipation, but they can be a great tool to have for families who often feel powerless when their child is complaining of pain.
Yeah.
You know, at school, the kid has crampy pain after they eat lunch, and every day they're in the nurse's office. And they find that using something as simple as hyoscyamine, a sublingual preparation or a tablet that you swallow with minimal side effects, really helps them. And so it's a medicine that is probably one of the first things that you can try. And you can try that, you know, as a general provider with feeling pretty safe that it's, you know, a safe side effect profile, and it's not an expensive medicine either. Even if it's not covered by their insurance, it's usually less than $30 for a month's worth.
What's the onset of action time?
Fairly quick, you know, 10 to 15 minutes is what I often quote to families. If a child has pain that's less than that, then you probably don't need a medicine. You know, it might pass, and doing things like distraction or relaxation techniques, like breathing techniques, things like that might be all they need. But yeah, within 10, 15 minutes, it usually works. Some patients find that their symptoms are triggered by eating. We occasionally will have patients take them prophylactically before a meal, and it actually prevents them from having a crummy post-meal experience where they're either rushing to the bathroom or having crampy pain. We usually say 15 to 30 minutes before a meal is when they would take those.
Well, and sometimes given that there's a link of stress with abdominal pain, sometimes even knowing that you have this thing helps preventively too.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you bring up perhaps the placebo effect.
Well, not even placebo effect, but knowing that you've got it.
Right. And knowing that you have it is absolutely reassuring. You've got a safety net. It's reassuring for families and kids, and they don't have to worry at school if they know they can even have it in their own pocket. If it's okay with the school and family, they can just kind of, you know, have that as an option. I do want to talk about placebo a little bit, though, because they've done very interesting studies examining the placebo effect. As providers, we shouldn't be afraid to talk about it, and it just shows the power of the brain-gut connection.
Right. So
they did a very interesting study with some of the neurogastroenterologists from the Buckeye State where I did my training out at Nationwide Children's, and they actually gave kids, they told them up front that they were giving them a placebo, a sugar pill. This is a sugar pill, but you can take it anytime you have abdominal pain. And there's a certain subset of families that said, we know this is a sugar pill, but how can we get more? Because this is absolutely helping my child. The patient knew, the family knew, the provider knew, everybody knew, but it just shows the power of the brain and the gut. And so having something that the kid can do where you are empowered to do something can really be an empowering for helping you manage your disease.
That's huge. Quick comment on antidiarrheals. Do you use them?
Very rarely in kids. Very, very rarely do we use things that would slow down the gut, aside from the antispasmodics. So things like Imodium, we rarely use for kids with diarrhea. Maybe in teenagers we might use it occasionally. The biggest reason is we always worry about infectious diarrhea using slowing down the GI tract in the setting of infection.
Sure. And then finally, there are some medications that are used in general in pain syndromes, things like amitriptyline. Is there a role for those?
I think so, in a subset of patients. You know, I don't expect a general pediatrician or general practitioner necessarily to want to go that route and explore that with families, just because, you know, the side effect profile, if you were to overdose on a medicine like amitriptyline, a tricyclic antidepressant, it can cause arrhythmias, it could be dangerous in that aspect, and it might take some titration. You know, if you feel comfortable doing that, absolutely fine, but it's not a first line intervention that I use as a provider. We do use it in a number of patients. It's helpful for migraine headaches. We know it can be helpful for anxiety, can help nerve pain. And it has shown to be helpful in some patients with abdominal pain. There have been other studies that show that is no better than placebo for abdominal pain. So usually you would say if you're going to try it, you need to try it for at least 4 to 6 weeks, probably more like the 6 week. You're not going to see an improvement overnight. But we do use it on occasion, and it can be helpful for some patients where they really do feel better on it.
And as you're treating someone, are there red flags that say we're going down the wrong path?
I think if they start developing things, symptoms and signs that maybe initially weren't obvious, but they start losing weight, they're missing more and more school, they're unable to participate in their daily activities, you might need to readdress. It doesn't mean that you're missing something dangerous, but you might need to readdress your approach. Do you need to involve multidisciplinary management with behavioral medicine involved earlier, things like that?
Well, this has all been very helpful. I really appreciate this. You know what I think we ought to do next week? I think we ought to talk about constipation. That sounds like an interesting thought.
Yeah, I think we should just slow things down a little bit.
Slow things down. No, that sounds great. Thanks again for being with us. For those of you who have questions, which are so many of you, please send your questions to questions@vcurb.com. We'll talk next week.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.